Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we take a stack of sources, articles, and research and really distill them down into the crucial insights, giving you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed on complex topics.
Exactly. We do the heavy lifting so you don't have to.
And today, we're not just opening a topic, we're really peeling back the layers of a global empire, one that has, defined beauty for generations. Think about those iconic names: Estée Lauder itself, Clinique, La Mer products that promise allure, luxury, the very essence of, well, flawless skin. We're talking about the Estée Lauder Company's Inc., symbol EL, a massive global leader in prestige beauty, home to some of the most aspirational brands out there.
And that's where it gets really interesting, and frankly, a bit surprising for an empire built on such consistent elegance, such premium positioning. Even these titans, these companies that seem like paragons of consistent growth, they can find themselves facing truly monumental challenges. And Estée Lauder right now is navigating what our sources are calling its most significant operational and strategic challenge in recent history. It's a fascinating, and I'd argue, really vital case study.
How so?
Well, it shows how even the most established, seemingly unshakable players can suddenly find themselves at a profound crossroads, forced to basically reinvent themselves to survive and thrive in a changing world.
That's a powerful way to frame it. So our mission today for this deep dive is to unpack exactly what's happening behind that velvet curtain at Estée Lauder. We're going to dive deep into their current struggles, try to understand the dynamics, sometimes really tumultuous shifts happening across the entire global beauty industry, because you can't look at EL in isolation.
Absolutely not. The context is crucial.
And then we'll analyze their bold, pretty high-stakes turnaround strategy. And critically, we'll explore the competing investment cases, the bull versus the bear view for its future, because how this whole story unfolds has massive implications, not just for them, but for the industry. By the end of this, you'll have hopefully a clear, nuanced understanding of all the complex forces at play behind a brand you might know really well, maybe from your own bathroom counter or even your investment portfolio. So let's really unpack this beauty empire at a crossroads.
Okay, so where do we start? I mean, for decades, Estée Lauder was, and this is no exaggeration, a model of financial strength, consistent growth.
The gold standard, almost.
Pretty much. Their success was built on this unassailable foundation,
Yeah.
quality products, relentless innovation. They were always launching something, and this incredible understanding of the luxury consumer. What makes them tick?
They didn't just sell products, they sold aspiration.
Exactly. They weren't just a brand. They were the benchmark for premium positioning in beauty, synonymous with, aspirational living. But, and it's a big but, when you look at their recent financials, the reality today looks profoundly different.
How different are we talking?
Well, in fiscal year 2024, the company reported a decline in net sales, and not just a small dip, but a pretty dramatic contraction in profitability, too.
Okay, that's significant.
And it wasn't just a minor blip, a one-off bad quarter. It's a trend that has, kind of alarmingly, continued right into fiscal 2025. We're seeing a series of earnings misses, significant asset impairments, which basically means writing off value from past acquisitions, hinting at maybe some missteps there.
Ouch. Writing down assets is never a good sign.
No, it isn't. And repeated downward revisions to their financial guidance. They keep telling the market things will be worse than they previously thought. It's a really unusual and frankly worrying trajectory for a company of this stature.
It certainly is. And those aren't just, dry numbers on a page, are they? They're symptoms, as our sources point out, of much deeper interconnected problems.
Right. What's driving this?
Well, we're looking at what can only be described as a major structural disruption in the incredibly lucrative Asia travel retail ecosystem, that duty-free airport shopping world.
This is huge for that.
Massive. Then there are these significant complex shifts in consumer preferences happening within mainland China itself, a market that was not long ago their undeniable growth engine. Layer on top of that, really intensifying competition from nimble startups popping up everywhere, digitally savvy brands, and also resurgent giants like L'Oreal. And then there's this growing perception, at least among some analysts, that maybe their pace of innovation has started lagging behind some of their more agile peers.
It really does feel like a perfect storm has kind of gathered over this beauty titan, doesn't it? All these factors hitting at once.
It absolutely does. So how are they responding? You don't just sit there when this happens.
No, you don't. And they haven't. Management has launched a really comprehensive, truly aggressive plan. They've branded it Beauty Reimagined.
Catchy name.
It is. But this isn't just, you know, a small adjustment or a minor tweak to the marketing budget. It's a radical undertaking, underpinned by something very explicitly named the Profit Recovery and Growth Plan, or PRGP.
Profit Recovery and Growth Plan. Okay, okay, the name itself tells you a lot.
It signals the urgency, right?
Right.
And the severity of the situation they perceive themselves to be in.
So if this is beauty reimagined, what does this aggressive plan actually involve on the ground? Because we're hearing about some pretty drastic measures. Sounds like a fundamental overhaul.
You're right to pick up on drastic. The core actions detailed in our sources include significant organizational restructuring. That implies cutting layers, making reporting lines clearer, trying to become less bureaucratic.
Leaner and meaner, basically.
That's the idea. Mm-hmm. And quite substantial workforce reductions. We are talking about a deliberate pivot towards becoming a leaner, more agile company. One designed to be much more responsive to those rapid market shifts we just talked about.
And the goals. What are they hoping to achieve with all this disruption?
The explicit goals, as management has stated them, are crystal clear. One, restore profitability back towards historical levels. Two, free up capital, cash, to aggressively reinvest in high growth areas. Think digital marketing, cutting edge e-commerce platforms, data analytics.
Meeting the consumer where they are now, online.
Yeah. And three, ultimately, return the company to a path of sustainable, profitable growth. It is, by any measure, a massive undertaking. Immense implications for literally every part of their global operations.
This truly sounds like a make-or-break moment for Estée Lauder. You know, a real inflection point.
I think that's fair to say.
And for you as an investor, or even just someone watching global business trends, this creates a fascinating, almost binary tension. It sets up this classic bull versus bear scenario.
Mm-hmm. Two very different stories you could tell about the future.
Exactly. On one side, you have the deeply bullish perspective, the optimists. This view is really rooted in the enduring power of Estée Lauder's world-class brand portfolio.
Crown jewels.
Right. The argument is that these brands think La Mer, Jo Malone London, Tom Ford Beauty, they command significant consumer loyalty, they have undeniable pricing power, meaning they can charge a premium, and they have this proven track record that kind of transcends fleeting trends.
People aspire to own them.
They do. And the bulls anticipate a cyclical recovery in that critical Chinese market. They argue the current slowdown there is temporary, related to COVID fallout and economic wobbles, not some permanent shift away from luxury.
So they think China will bounce back and EL will benefit.
Precisely. And crucially, the bulls believe this profit recovery and growth plan, the PRGP, will be successfully executed. They think management can pull it off, unlock substantial margin expansion by stripping out those costs and inefficiencies, and transform the company into a far more efficient, resilient, and ultimately more profitable organization.
So it's a bet on the brands, the China rebound, and management execution.
Essentially, yes. A bet on the timeless allure of their brands and on management's ability to navigate this really complex turnaround.
Okay, that's a compelling narrative. But then you have the other side, the equally forceful, bearish perspective, the pessimists, if you will.
What's their take?
The bears really highlight the severe execution risk. That's paramount for them. They look at a transformation to this immense scale, huge global company, deep job cuts, sweeping organizational overhaul, and they see a very high probability of operational disruption. Things going wrong.
Like what?
Potential loss of key talent who gets spooked or cut. Maybe failure to even realize those projected cost savings. They question if the plan is just too ambitious, too disruptive. And a central question they pose is about Asia. Are the headwinds they're facing there merely cyclical temporary? Will eventually reverse.
Or
are they fundamentally structural, more permanent, representing a new diminished normal for those key markets, especially travel retail after the Daegu crackdown?
That's a huge difference in outlook.
Massive. And the bears raise serious concerns about potential permanent market share loss. Have nimbler, digitally native competitors gained ground during Estée Lauder's period of struggle? Ground that might not be easily regained.
Because consumer loyalty isn't guaranteed anymore.
Exactly. And critically, they point to the stock's forward valuation. They argue it appears to already price in a flawless and rapid recovery. There's a lot of optimism baked in.
Meaning there's little room for error.
Very little. If anything goes wrong, if the recovery is delayed, or if it proves less robust than the market hopes, the stock could fall sharply. It truly is a high-stakes gamble for anyone looking at this company right now.
It really is. And understanding that tension, that bull versus bear debate, it sets the stage perfectly for digging deeper. So let's maybe zoom out a bit first and look at the broader landscape of prestige beauty, because that context is absolutely crucial to understanding how Estée Lauder got into this position. The whole industry has been shifting, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Profound shifts. The post-pandemic boom, which saw really impressive, almost unprecedented growth across the beauty sector for a couple of years, that has definitively given way to a far more challenging, much more intensely competitive landscape now.
So the easy growth days are over.
Pretty much. To put some numbers on it, the global beauty industry grew an impressive 7% annually from 2022 to 2024. That's a strong tailwind, lifting almost everyone. But now, forecasts suggest it's going to expand at a much more moderate 5% annual rate through 2030.
Still growing, but slower. What does that mean practically?
It means market share gains are far harder to achieve. Companies can no longer just rely on that rising tide lifting all boats. Every percentage point of growth now has to be fought for, often directly at the expense of a competitor. Becomes a zero-sum game in many ways.
And it's not just a general slowdown, is it? Our sources talk about a real divergence in how different categories are performing. What's driving the growth these days? Because it feels like the spotlight has shifted quite dramatically.
The spotlight has unequivocally shifted to fragrance. It has emerged as the industry's primary, most potent growth engine right now.
Really? Perfume and cologne?
Yes. We saw U.S. prestige fragrance sales surging by a remarkable 12% in 2024 alone. That's huge growth.
Wow. Why? What's behind that surge?
Well, it isn't just about new perfumes hitting the market. It reflects what many economists and industry analysts are calling a new lipstick effect. You know the old theory.
Yeah. During tough times, people buy small luxuries like lipstick instead of big ticket items.
Exactly. Today, in this environment of increased economic uncertainty, maybe some lingering inflation worries, a new exquisite scent offers that sense of luxury, that personal indulgence, that emotional uplift. But without the steep price tag of, say, a designer handbag or a big vacation, it's an accessible way to feel luxurious, feel good about yourself. And brands have absolutely capitalized on that sentiment.
That's fascinating, because skincare, which has historically been Estée Lauder's absolute bread and butter, the core of their empire, that's now the softest growing category in U.S. prestige beauty.
That's right, up a mere 2% in 2024, a huge deceleration from its boom years. And makeup, you asked about makeup, that's somewhere in the middle ground.
How's makeup doing?
Prestige makeup sales grew a modest 5%. But interestingly, the mass market segment of makeup, the drugstore stuff, actually experienced a 3% decline.
What does that tell us?
It indicates a very clear bifurcation in consumer spending, a split. On one hand, you still have consumers willing to splurge on high-end premium makeup products, maybe for specific results or brands they love or for special occasions. But on the other hand, the mass market is facing pressure. It suggests consumers are either opting for very accessible, budget-friendly alternatives, maybe those dupes we'll talk about, or perhaps they're investing more in other categories like fragrance and skincare, or maybe just buying less makeup overall.
And for Estée Lauder, this slowdown in their core skincare category must be particularly problematic.
Oh, absolutely. It directly impacts their biggest, most established anchor brands like Estée Lauder and Clinique. It hits them right where it hurts, historically speaking.
And geographically, it's not just about the U.S. and China anymore, is it? We always think of those two giants, but the sources point to a kind of rebalancing act happening. Where's the new growth coming from?
Yeah, that's a key shift. While the U.S. and China absolutely remain the industry's largest, most vital markets, you can't ignore them, the engines of future growth seem to be undergoing a significant rebalancing.
How's the U.S. market holding up?
The U.S. prestige market itself actually expanded a healthy 7% to nearly $34 billion in 2024. So it's still a key battleground and a source of strength for many brands. It's resilient.
But China? The story there is changing.
Yes. China's rebound from COVID is broadly expected to be slower, perhaps less robust than its pre-pandemic breakneck pace. There are ongoing economic challenges, shifts in consumer confidence. It's more complicated now. This means companies can't just rely on China's sheer volume growth like they used to.
So where are they looking instead?
Increasingly, emerging markets. Places like India and the Middle East are being identified as the most promising new growth frontiers. These regions are seeing rapid economic development, a burgeoning middle class with disposable income, and a growing appetite for luxury goods and global brands. Companies need to think more globally now, adapt their strategies beyond just the U.S. and China.
So if the market is slowing overall, shifting geographically, how is the consumer themselves changing in this new landscape? Because I'm hearing a lot about something really fundamental, value consciousness. People are watching their wallets more.
Value consciousness is, without a doubt, paramount right now. It's maybe the single biggest shift. Increased economic uncertainty, those persistent inflationary pressures we all felt, a general sense of global instability. It's clearly created a more discerning, far more value-conscious shopper across the board.
Is there data backing that up?
Yes. A McKinsey survey we looked at found that a staggering 75% of beauty executives expect consumer scrutiny on perceived value to be the single most significant theme shaping the industry for years to come. That's huge.
Three quarters of execs see that as number one.
Exactly. And this isn't just theoretical. It's impacting purchasing decisions directly. Our sources indicate that 24% of consumers, nearly a quarter, admit to having actively traded down to cheaper products in the past year. Consciously choosing a more affordable alternative for something they needed or wanted, that signals a fundamental shift in brand loyalty and how people perceive worth.
And that leads directly into this whole dupe trend, doesn't it? I've seen so much about it online, especially on platforms like TikTok. It seems explosive. What exactly is a dupe in this context, and why is it such a potential threat to prestige brands like Estee Lauder?
Yeah, the dupe phenomenon is a really powerful manifestation of this value consciousness. So a dupe, short for duplicate, refers to a lower-cost alternative product that closely mimics a popular, often high-end prestige product. This mimicry could be in terms of appearance, packaging, key ingredients, or importantly, the purported performance or effect.
So it looks like, feels like, or claims to work like the expensive stuff, but costs way less.
Precisely. And consumers are no longer just casually stumbling upon these. They are actively seeking them out. They're hunting for dupes. In the U.S., 27% of beauty shoppers admit to purchasing dupes, with Amazon emerging as a primary destination for these bargain hunts. You can search dupe for X product and find tons of options.
Almost a third of shoppers buying dupes. Wow. What's driving that beyond just saving money?
Well, what's truly fascinating here and deeply problematic for brands built on prestige is that this behavior is increasingly driven by a growing widespread belief held by 64% of consumers, according to one study, that premium beauty products are not inherently higher performing than their mass market counterparts.
64%. That challenges the entire premise of luxury beauty.
It absolutely does. It challenges the very notion of prestige justification. The idea that a higher price automatically equates to superior quality, better ingredients, or more efficacy. It's a fundamental undermining of the traditional luxury narrative. If people believe the cheap version works just as well, why pay 10 times more?
That's a huge shift in perception. It implies that the aura of a luxury brand, that intangible feeling, might be losing its grip, or at least isn't enough on its own anymore.
I think that's right. Performance and perceived value are becoming much more important drivers.
And this ties in perfectly with the rise of Generation Z, who seem to be shaking things up everywhere across all industries. How are they influencing the beauty market specifically? They seem like a totally different kind of consumer.
Oh, Gen Z is an absolutely formidable force, not just influencing, but actively reshaping the beauty market in their image. For starters, they're entering the beauty market earlier than previous generations. The average age is now 12.
12? Wow.
Yeah, that's a full year earlier than teens a decade ago, which means they're forming brand preferences, developing habits, and starting to spend much earlier.
And are they spending significantly?
Remarkably so. They drove a phenomenal 23% year-over-year increase in beauty spending in 2023. They are a major economic force already.
Okay, so they're young, but they have money to spend on beauty. How do they shop? How do they discover brands?
Well, this cohort is fundamentally digitally native. They grew up with smartphones and social media. So they discover brands primarily through platforms like TikTok and Instagram, not through traditional advertising in magazines or on TV. They see it on their feeds from creators they follow.
Makes sense.
They are also true omnichannel shoppers. They're comfortable seamlessly transitioning between researching online, watching tutorials, clicking buy now on social media, or going into a store like Sephora or Ulta to try things out. It's all integrated for them.
And who do they trust? Celebrities. Big influencers.
Interestingly, no. While they consume vast amounts of social media content, their trust lies far more with family and friends, and also with those micro-influencers who feel more authentic, more like a friend giving advice, rather than traditional celebrity endorsements or macro-influencers who seem purely commercial.
So authenticity is key for them.
Hugely key. This signals a strong demand for authenticity, transparency, and relatability from the brands they choose. They don't just want to buy a product. They want to buy into a genuine conversation, a community, and a set of values that resonate with them. Brands need to be real with them.
So we've got this backdrop, a slowing market, category shifts, new geographies emerging, and this totally different, more discerning, digitally native consumer demographic taking the reins with Gen Z. What are the big overarching industry trends that are fundamentally shaping the future of beauty? It sounds like the entire landscape is undergoing a complete transformation.
It absolutely is. Several powerful trends are converging, really redefining the industry. First, and maybe most obvious, is digital dominance. It's undeniable and growing at an astonishing pace.
How dominant are we talking?
Online channels are projected to account for nearly one-third of global beauty sales by 2030. That is a massive shift away from traditional retail like department stores or even standalone brand stores.
A third of all sales online.
Wow. Yeah. And social media platforms, especially with their short-form video formats, think TikTok, Instagram Reels, and the explosive growth of live selling, where influencers or brand reps sell products in real-time interactive streams, these are now indispensable tools.
It's not just marketing anymore. It's the actual point of sale.
Exactly. Think about TikTok's shop features or brands selling millions of dollars worth of product in a single live stream event, particularly in Asia. They're not just marketing tools, they're powerful direct sales channels.
Okay, digital is huge. What about clean beauty and sustainability? Is that still kind of a niche, an optional extra for brands, or has it truly gone mainstream now?
It's unequivocally mainstream. It's moved from being a niche preference to a core expectation for a huge swath of consumers. The demand for clean products formulated without certain controversial ingredients like parabens or sulfates, and for brands to demonstrate genuinely sustainable practices, is now a core part of many consumers' decision-making process.
So people are checking labels, looking beyond the marketing claims.
They are. Consumers are increasingly scrutinizing ingredient lists, looking into supply chains, questioning packaging materials. However, and this is important, they're also becoming incredibly skeptical of greenwashing.
Right, where companies make vague or misleading claims about how eco-friendly they are.
Exactly. So this means brands have to genuinely walk the talk. They need to provide transparent information, maybe third-party certifications, and actually prove their commitment, not just make empty promises or use buzzwords. Authenticity matters here, too.
I've also seen a lot of talk recently about inclusivity and personalization, especially with new tech like AI. How are those playing out? Are they just buzzwords, or are they becoming real expectations?
Far from buzzwords now. These are becoming fundamental consumer expectations and, frankly, competitive necessities for brands. Inclusivity, for instance, extends way beyond just offering a truly wide range of foundation shades to cater to all skin tones and undertones, although that's still critically important.
What else does it involve?
It involves ensuring genuinely diverse representation in advertising campaigns, in product development teams, in who the brand speaks to and features. According to one report, we saw 50% of consumers now actively prioritize inclusive beauty when making purchasing decisions. They want to see themselves reflected.
Half of consumers prioritizing that, that's significant.
It is, and this is closely linked to the trend of hyper-personalization. This is where advanced AI, artificial intelligence, and AR augmented reality technologies are really coming into play.
How so? What can they do?
They enable things like virtual try-on experiences for makeup or hair color using your phone's camera. They allow for customized product recommendations based on your unique skin concerns identified through, say, an online quiz or even a selfie analysis. Some companies are even moving towards bespoke formulations mixed just for you.
Tailor-made beauty.
Essentially, yes. And consumers are coming to expect this. In fact, 71% of consumers now expect a personalized shopping experience online. This is a game changer for customer engagement and loyalty, as it makes the whole beauty journey feel uniquely tailored to the individual, not just a one-size-fits-all approach.
And finally, a trend that's really reshaped the skincare landscape globally, maybe more than any other in recent years, K-beauty, the Korean beauty phenomenon. It feels like it came out of nowhere for many Western consumers, but now it's just everywhere, a dominant force.
It absolutely is. The global ascent of Korean beauty has had a profound, truly transformative impact on the entire industry, especially skincare.
Yeah.
It fundamentally shifted the industry's focus towards those famous multi-step skincare routines, often involving 7, 10, even more steps.
Where the essences, serums, and pools.
All of that. It popularized innovative ingredients that were largely unknown in the West before, things like snail mucin, Centella Asiatica, fermented extracts. And it championed a whole philosophy centered on achieving healthy, glowing, glass skin from within, rather than just covering imperfections with makeup.
And it's had a real economic impact too, hasn't it?
Huge. The sheer scale is clear when you look at trade figures. South Korea has actually surpassed France to become the top cosmetics exporter to the United States.
Mm.
That's a monumental shift in the global beauty hierarchy, unthinkable just a decade or two ago.
So what's the secret? Why has K-Beauty been so successful globally?
The core of K-Beauty's success really lies in offering high-quality, incredibly innovative formulations. They're masters of texture and new ingredients, but at remarkably accessible price points. You get cutting-edge skincare without the traditional luxury markup.
Innovation plus affordability, that's a powerful combination.
It is. And that, naturally, further pressures the traditional value proposition of established prestige brands like Estée Lauder, who have historically relied on their premium positioning, their heritage, and maybe a bit of mystique to justify those higher prices.
Yeah.
K-Beauty effectively showed consumers you could have both high quality and affordability. You didn't necessarily have to choose anymore.
Okay. So if we connect all these dots now, the rise of this super value conscious consumer, the widespread credibility and availability of dupes, the explosive growth and influence of the affordable yet innovative K-Beauty phenomenon, what does this all mean collectively for traditional prestige brands like Estée Lauder? It really sounds like they're caught in a profound, almost unavoidable squeeze.
Precisely. You've nailed it. This creates what our sources describe as a structural challenge.
Yeah.
Key word there is structural, not temporary, for prestige incumbents like Estée Lauder. Imagine it like a pincer movement, squeezing them hard from two sides and eroding their historical pricing power, which was the bedrock of their profitability.
What are the two sides of the pincer?
Okay, on one side, you have these increasingly savvy consumers. They're armed with more information than ever before, thanks to the internet, social media reviews, ingredient databases, and they're presented with a growing plethora of high-quality, accessible alternatives. They can find a dupe for almost any high-end product now, compare ingredients online, and genuinely believe, as we saw, that it performs just as well.
So the information asymmetry that used to favor luxury brands is gone.
Largely gone, yes. Then on the other side of the pincer, you have the K-Beauty phenomenon and other innovative, often lower-priced brands. They deliver true innovation, exciting textures, and proven efficacy without that traditional luxury price tag. They've set a new benchmark for value in many consumers' minds.
So consumers are asking, why pay more?
Exactly. The confluence of these trends informed consumers demanding value, readily available dupes, and innovative affordable alternatives like K-Beauty collectively erodes the historical pricing power that was so crucial to the prestige model's profitability. The core insight here, I think, is that the aura of luxury, the brand name alone, isn't enough anymore for many consumers.
It needs to be backed by tangible value or performance.
Yes. Value, transparency, authentic connection, and demonstrable performance at a price perceived as reasonable. These are increasingly winning out. And for a company like Estée Lauder, traditionally concentrated at the highest end of the market, relying heavily on that premium positioning and the ability to command exceptionally high prices, this structural challenge is a direct, fundamental threat to their long-term margins and their market share. It forces them to rethink their whole value proposition.
That's a critical, almost existential point for them to grapple with.
Okay, let's turn our attention back squarely to Estée Lauder specifically now and how they stack up in this new, much more challenging environment. What does their market share actually tell us, and how do they benchmark against their key peers? Are they still the dominant force they once were in their core categories?
Yeah, in terms of sheer scale, Estée Lauder absolutely remains a significant global player. There's no denying that. Globally, they rank as the third largest beauty company by sales overall, trailing only the absolute giants L'Oreal and Unilever.
Okay, so still top three globally, that's big. What about specific markets or categories?
In the crucial North American skincare market, a real battleground, they held the third position back in 2021, according to the data we have, with about an 8.3% market share. That placed them behind L'Oreal, which had 10.3%, and Johnson & Johnson, primarily Neutrogena, at 8.5%. So they clearly have scale and an established presence, but maybe not the dominant number one spot everywhere. Okay, so they're a major player, top three in key areas, no doubt. But you mentioned a performance gap earlier when talking at the overall market slowdown. What does that look like when we compare them directly to their closest competitors right now? Because the numbers in our sources, especially in that comparison table, are quite stark.
They truly are stark, and this is where the company-specific issues really come into focus. While the overall market, as we said, is decelerating, Estée Lauder sales have actually been contracting in recent periods. That's a key negative differentiator.
So others are growing slower, but EL is shrinking.
In some recent quarters, yes.
Yeah.
In contrast, direct peers like L'Oreal and LVMH particularly LVMH's perfumes and cosmetics division, which includes brands like Dior and Guerlain, have demonstrated much greater resilience and, importantly, continued to post positive growth, even if slower than before.
What does that suggest?
It strongly suggests that Estée Lauder's issues aren't solely due to market-wide headwinds hitting everyone equally. There are clearly company-specific execution challenges at play, perhaps exacerbated by their particular exposure to those troubled channels like Asia travel retail, maybe their specific brand mix.
Can you give us those numbers again? That comparison really hits home.
Sure. If you look at the reported numbers for fiscal year 2024, Estee Lauder reported negative 2% revenue growth year over year. And maybe even more concerning, their group operating margin was just 6.2%.
Only 6 cents of profit for every dollar of sales? That seems low for luxury.
It is low for luxury, historically for them especially. Now, compare that to L'Oreal in a similar period. They managed positive 5.1% revenue growth and posted an impressive 20% operating margin. LVMH's beauty division, 1% growth, but a very healthy 23.1% operating margin. Even Coty, which is smaller and has faced its own challenges, managed 11% revenue growth and an 8.9% margin.
Wow, that disparity, particularly in profitability, the operating margin, is huge. It really speaks volumes about the specific challenges Estee Lauder is grappling with right now compared to its peers.
It absolutely does. They're lagging significantly on both top-line momentum and bottom-line profitability.
Okay, let's talk about Estee Lauder's brand portfolio. It's often cited, as you said, as their primary competitive advantage, this exceptional collection of over 20 prestige brands across different categories. But is that still a clear strength in today's environment? Or is it becoming something of a double-edged sword now, especially with this brand paradox idea you hinted at earlier?
It's absolutely a double-edged sword now. And that brand paradox gets right to the heart of their current strategic dilemma. On one hand, yes, it truly is an exceptional portfolio. Highly diversified across skincare, makeup, fragrance, hair care. You've got the powerhouse anchor brands, the names that built the empire. Estee Lauder itself, Clinique, and the ultra-luxury La Mer. These have historically driven the bulk of sales and profits, building immense brand equity over decades.
They're the foundation.
Absolutely. However, and here's the other edge of the sword, these are precisely the brands that have been at the epicenter of the recent downturn. They experienced significant sales declines primarily because of their heavy exposure to those challenged Asian markets, particularly China and the collapsing travel retail channel. They were the engine, yes, but that engine is now sputtering badly due to these external factors and maybe some internal issues too.
But they also have these fantastic growth and acquired brands, don't they? Names that seem much more current and are performing well, like The Ordinary from Deciem, the K-beauty brand Dr. Jart, plus Tom Ford Beauty, Le Labo, Jo Malone London. These seem to be resonating strongly with modern consumers, right?
They absolutely are resonating. Through what was for a long time very astute M&A activity, Estee Lauder built up this stable of high-growth, on-trend brands that are performing well, sometimes exceptionally well, and connecting strongly with younger, digitally native consumers. These brands really represent the future growth potential of the company.
So that's the positive side. What's the problem?
The problem is, critically, that their impressive growth, while a definite positive signal and proof they can pick winners, has unfortunately been insufficient so far, at least to fully offset the steep declines they've seen in those larger core anchor brands. The hole created by the legacy brand slump is just too big for the growth brands to fill entirely right now.
Okay, so the newer brands aren't big enough yet to carry the whole company.
Not yet. And this brings us right back to that fascinating, almost self-defeating brand paradox operating within the company itself.
Tell me more about that paradox. It sounds like a real internal tension, maybe even a conflict.
It's precisely that. A profound internal tension regarding brand positioning and value proposition. Consider the phenomenal runaway success of a brand like The Ordinary, which EL acquired through Deciem. Its entire identity, its whole value proposition, is built on radical ingredient transparency. Here's exactly what's in the bottle. Minimalist marketing and incredibly accessible, almost shockingly low pricing for effective formulations.
Right, you can get powerful serums for like $10.
Exactly. Now think about what that success implicitly does. It validates the very consumer trend we discussed earlier. People questioning the value proposition of high-priced luxury skincare. If The Ordinary, owned by Estee Lauder, can deliver effective niacinamide or hyaluronic acid formulations for $10, why should a consumer pay $200, $300, or even more for a seemingly similar product from another brand, maybe even another brand within the Estee Lauder portfolio?
I see. The success of their cheap brand undermines the justification for their expensive brands.
Precisely. This success, while obviously good for Yale's top line in that Dasym segment, potentially cannibalizes the positioning and erodes the perceived value of Yale's own ultra-premium brands, like La Mer, which rely heavily on an aura of exclusivity, proprietary ingredients like the Miracle Broth, luxurious packaging, and a justification for their incredibly high price points.
It's like they're competing with themselves, sending mixed messages to the consumer.
In a way, Jess, imagine being the marketing director for La Mer, trying to convince people your $500 cream is worth every penny because of its unique science and heritage, while another division of your own company is successfully selling potent ingredients based on transparency and affordability. Managing this internal tension, where one part of your portfolio's success fundamentally challenges the business model and pricing strategy of another, arguably more profitable, part requires an exceptionally sophisticated, incredibly nuanced, and frankly, very delicate marketing and portfolio strategy.
It sounds like a real tightrope walk. A misstep could damage brand equity across the board, couldn't it? Either making the luxury brands seem overpriced or the affordable brands seem less effective.
Absolutely. It's a very tricky balancing act, and it highlights the complexity of managing such a diverse portfolio in today's market, where consumers are so much more informed and skeptical about price versus value.
That's a deep insight and a huge strategic challenge for them.
Okay, what about their distribution channels? How they actually get products to us? Historically, they've been incredibly strong in traditional department stores. Think Macy's, Nordstrom, and more recently in that travel retail channel we keep mentioning. Has that historical strength ironically become a significant vulnerability in today's market?
It has, absolutely, and dramatically so. Estee Lauder employs a multi-channel distribution model, which is usually a strength, providing diversification. But historically, their sales were heavily weighted towards those traditional department stores, accounting for a significant 38% of revenue not too long ago. And as we noted, travel retail grew enormously, peaking at maybe 13% officially, but likely much higher in reality when you factor in the gray market.
So department stores and travel retail were their two biggest pillars. Yes. And this channel mix, once a pillar of strength providing premium environments and broad reach, has unfortunately proven to be a significant vulnerability in recent years. Why? Well, first, the secular decline of department store foot traffic. That's been an ongoing trend for years now, right? Driven by the rise of e-commerce, the growth of specialized beauty retailers like Sephora and Ulta, People just aren't browsing department store beauty counters like they used to. And that has disproportionately impacted EL, given their historical reliance.
Okay, so the department store decline was a slow burn, but the travel retail issue sounds like it was much more sudden and acute.
Catastrophic is probably not too strong a word. The structural disruption in the travel retail channel has been absolutely devastating for Estee Lauder.
And that over-reliance on travel retail in particular sounds like it became a huge systemic risk that maybe masked other underlying issues in the business for a while.
It did, precisely. And this is truly critical to understanding their current predicament, maybe the single biggest factor. At its peak, this channel accounted for an astonishing 27% of Estee Lauder's total revenue in fiscal 2022. 27%.
Almost a third of their business tied to airports and duty-free.
Yeah. And here's the crucial part. Our sources highlight a huge, perhaps even the largest portion of this volume was artificially inflated. It was fueled by the unsustainable Daigou reseller market.
Can you explain Daigou again? Because it's central to this whole story.
Sure. So Daigou literally means buying on behalf of in Chinese. It refers to this massive unofficial gray market where individuals, primarily based in China or traveling frequently, would buy large quantities of high-demand luxury goods, especially cosmetics in duty-free zones. Think places like Hainan Island in China, which became a huge Daigou hub, or South Korea's airports, or even further afield. They'd buy these products at lower tax-free prices.
And then what?
And then they would illegally resell them, often through social media or e-commerce platforms within mainland China, at a significant profit. They were essentially bypassing official import duties, taxes, and the brand's official distribution channels in China. It was, in essence, a massive, albeit unofficial and completely unregulated, distribution pipeline for brands like Estee Lauder into the lucrative Chinese market.
Wow. So a huge chunk of their travel retail sales weren't actually going to travelers using the products themselves.
A very significant chunk, yes. It was going to these professional resellers. And the abrupt collapse of this market, following a stringent, deliberate Chinese government crackdown on this practice, they wanted to curb tax evasion and encourage official domestic consumption, exposed a critical lack of diversification in Estee Lauder's revenue streams. It also brutally masked underlying weakness in other key domestic markets, like maybe their core U.S. consumer business wasn't as strong as the overall numbers suggested because travel retail was booming so much.
It was like this hidden pipeline propping up the numbers, and then suddenly the government turned off the tap.
Exactly. It dried up almost overnight.
So it wasn't just a general slowdown in consumer travel after COVID. It was this direct, targeted attack on their unofficial distribution network, which is essentially built on price arbitrage.
Precisely. The end of travel restrictions actually dispersed spending somewhat, but the crackdown on Daigou was the killer blow. And in response to this harsh new reality, both Estee Lauder and its travel retail partners, the duty-free operators, were forced to undertake an incredibly painful but absolutely necessary inventory reset.
What did that involve? Sounds bad.
It was bad for short-term sales. They had mountains of excess stock sitting in those duty-free warehouses and stores, stock that was previously destined for the Daigou resellers. With that demand gone, they had to stop shipping new products into the channel, drastically reduce orders, and work through selling off that overhang. Essentially, they had to empty the pipeline, and that naturally caused a steep, immediate, and very deep drop in reported sales for the travel retail segment.
Because they weren't selling into the channel anymore, even if some product was still selling through to actual travelers.
Correct. The sell-in numbers plummeted. The severity of this whole situation, and perhaps how reliant the company had become on it, even led to a shareholder lawsuit. The suit alleges that the company failed to properly disclose its true reliance on the fragile Daigou market and potentially misled investors about the sustainability and health of this massive revenue stream.
So there are legal ramifications, too. And what's the outlook now for travel retail? Is it expected to bounce back quickly?
No. Management themselves, looking forward, have stated they don't expect a return to growth in this channel until fiscal 2026 at the earliest. That's a long recovery period.
And the Daigou crackdown, you're saying, isn't just a temporary hurdle they can somehow wait out or work around. This is a permanent change to the game.
That's the absolutely crucial insight here. And it's what differentiates this from a typical cyclical downturn in travel. This is viewed by almost all analysts as a permanent structural change to the business model of travel retail, particularly for high-volume luxury goods categories like cosmetics. The previous sales volumes, which were so incredibly significant for Estee Lauder, were artificially inflated by this gray market arbitrage. It wasn't real underlying consumer demand at that level.
So the channel itself will be smaller going forward?
Yes. The new normal for this channel will be a smaller, hopefully more sustainable business focused purely on sales to actual individual travelers and genuine consumers, not these professional resellers buying in bulk. And this means a fundamental reset of long-term growth expectations and probably margin expectations too, for what was once the company's single most important, highest growth engine. That channel, in the view of most experts, will simply never return to its former bloated, Daigou-fueled size.
That's a massive adjustment for them to make. Okay, so besides this huge Asia-Pacific crisis, are they still dealing with the broader inflationary pressures and supply chain issues that pretty much all global companies have faced over the last few years?
Briefly, yes, they are, although maybe it's less of a headline issue now compared to the demand-side problems. Like virtually all consumer goods companies, they've definitely faced persistent margin pressure from cost inflation, higher prices for raw materials, packaging components, energy, logistics, labor across their global operations.
Have they been able to pass those costs on through higher prices?
They have implemented strategic price increases across their portfolio to try and offset some of this. However, our sources suggest that the recent improvements we've seen in their gross margin are probably more attributable to the aggressive cost-saving initiatives kicking in from the PRGP and also simply lapping or moving past those prior year inventory-related charges and write-downs associated with the travel retail reset. It's less about pricing power right now, more about cost-cutting and accounting normalization.
And are they doing anything structurally to address costs and supply chain efficiency?
Yes, they are actively investing in modernizing their global supply chain. This includes opening a massive new distribution center in Switzerland, designed to improve efficiency and service levels in Europe and beyond. They're also launching extensive upskilling programs for their workforce, likely focused on digital skills and adapting to more automated processes. This is all designed to enhance efficiency in the long run and build greater resilience against future disruptions, whether they're geopolitical, logistical, or demand-related.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's now get into the real nitty-gritty details of this Beauty Reimagined turnaround plan. It's clearly massive, high stakes. What are the specifics of the Profit Recovery and Growth Plan, PRGP, which you said is the financial backbone of this whole strategy?
Right. The PRGP is the financial engine driving Beauty Reimagined, and its ambitions are really substantial. The headline goal is to generate a very significant $0.8 billion to $1 billion in annual gross benefits, mostly cost savings and efficiencies by the time they get to fiscal 2026.
$1 billion in annual savings? That's a huge target.
It's massive. However, achieving those savings comes at a significant upfront cost. The company anticipates incurring an estimated $1.2 billion to $1.6 billion in pre-tax restructuring and other charges to implement the plan. You know, things like severance costs, facility closures, consulting fees. So they have to spend a lot of money now to hopefully save even more money later.
Spend money to save money. Makes sense. What's the biggest lever they're pulling to get those savings? It sounds like workforce reduction is a major part of it.
It is a major and obviously very impactful component of this plan. They announced a significant global workforce reduction. They are cutting between 5,800 to 7,000 positions worldwide.
Wow, what percentage of their workforce is that?
It represents up to 11% of the company's total global workforce. So more than 1 in 10 employees potentially impacted. This isn't just trimming a bit of fat around the edges. It's a profound reshaping of their human capital structure, aiming for a much leaner organization.
That's huge. And it's coupled with major organizational and leadership changes as well, isn't it? Which maybe speaks to a desire for a deeper cultural shift, not just cost cutting.
It absolutely is coupled with that. And you've hit on the key point. The scale suggests it's about cultural transformation too. The plan includes a sweeping overhaul of the company's leadership and its organizational structure. Most notably, longtime CEO Fabrizio Freda, who successfully led the company for a very impressive 15 years, overseeing a period of tremendous growth, He announced his retirement.
End of an era there. Who's replacing him?
Stephane de la Favrie, who is an experienced internal executive, someone who knows the company well, is set to take over as CEO in early 2025. This is a huge shift at the very top.
And structurally, below the CEO level.
The company is also consolidating its sprawling regional structure. They used to have many different regional hubs. Now they're moving to just 4 leaner geographic clusters. The stated goal here, according to management, is to break down silos between regions and brands, foster greater collaboration, speed up communication, and crucially, increase decision-making speed across the organization. They recognize they need to be faster, more agile in today's rapidly changing beauty market.
The sheer scale of this restructuring, those deep job cuts, the change in a long-tenured successful CEO consolidating entire regions, it signals something much deeper than just hitting a rough patch financially, doesn't it? It really suggests the problems are seen as systemic, maybe even cultural.
It screams it, doesn't it? Our sources really emphasize this point of the sheer scale and intensity of this restructuring clearly signaled that the board of directors and significantly the controlling Lauder family view the company's problems as deep-seated and cultural, not merely cyclical or superficial. They see a need for fundamental change in how the company operates.
So it's not just about external market forces hitting them. It's about internal agility, decision-making, maybe complacency.
That seems to be the implication behind such drastic actions. This is by definition a very high-risk, high-reward strategy. If they successfully pull it off, it could indeed create a more competitive, more resilient, more responsive organization, truly ready for the challenges of the next decade.
But the flip side?
The flip side is, if it's mismanaged, such a large-scale overhaul could easily lead to prolonged operational disruption, confusion, a major loss of critical institutional knowledge, and key talent walking out the door, and ultimately, it could even fail to achieve its intended financial benefits. That would leave the company in an even more precarious position than before. The stakes couldn't be higher.
Absolutely. And a core pillar of this turnaround, alongside the cost-cutting and restructuring, is also digital transformation, correct? In a world dominated by Gen Z, TikTok, e-commerce, how are they executing on that front? Are they truly embracing AI and shifting their focus online?
It is an absolutely vital component, yes. And an area where they arguably need to make significant strides quickly to catch up or keep pace. Estee Lauder is actively deepening its partnerships with major technology giants like Microsoft and Adobe. The goal is to integrate artificial intelligence more thoroughly into its operations, particularly in customer-facing roles and marketing functions.
What's the focus there? How are they using AI?
The primary focus right now seems to be on personalizing marketing campaigns, making ads and offers more relevant to individual consumers based on their data, and crucially, improving their return on investment, ROI, from advertising spend, making sure those marketing dollars work harder.
Are they seeing results?
Early results from these efforts have actually been quite promising, according to the company. They've reported mid-single-digit growth in their online sales channels, even while their overall top line has been contracting. That suggests that digital investments are starting to yield some fruit, driving growth where the traditional channels are struggling.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, they highlighted a pilot program using an AI-powered tool they called Promo Investigator. Its purpose was to optimize their bidding strategy for paid search advertising, you know, Google Ads. This tool reportedly increased their return on ad spend by a remarkable 47%. That's a direct, measurable impact on profitability from using AI smarter.
Okay, 47% ROI increase is definitely impressive for a specific initiative. But what are the challenges with scaling something like that up across such a huge, complex, global organization with dozens of brands? And are they leveraging AI in other critical areas too, beyond just marketing efficiency?
Well, the main challenges undoubtedly lie exactly there. Scaling these promising but often localized initiatives across such a vast, complex global organization, ensuring consistency, getting buy-in, training people, integrating systems across all brands and all regions, that's a massive operational lift.
And the second part of my question, are they using AI elsewhere?
That's where there might be a gap. As we touched on briefly earlier, while their AI focus has been strong and seemingly effective in marketing and operational efficiency, like that Promo Investigator example, the company may still be lagging behind some key competitors, notably L'Oreal, who are reported to be more deeply integrating AI into core R&D and the actual product development process.
How is L'Oreal using AI in R&D?
Reports suggest L'Oreal uses AI algorithms to predict how different ingredients might interact, to analyze vast amounts of scientific literature, to identify promising new actives, and even to help formulate new products faster, essentially shortening the innovation cycle from concept to shelf.
So AI finding the next blockbuster ingredient or formulation?
Potentially, yes. Or at least accelerating the process significantly. If Estee Lauder doesn't catch up in leveraging AI for this fundamental aspect of the beauty business, creating new, innovative products, it could become a significant long-term competitive disadvantage. It would make it harder for them to develop those next big thing products that consumers, especially younger ones, are constantly demanding. Marketing efficiency is great, but you also need exciting new products to market.
That's a really important point. Okay, shifting gears slightly, let's look at capital allocation, how the company uses its money. What does this crisis, this whole turnaround effort, mean for you, the investor, in terms of how Estee Lauder is prioritizing its cash? How have their capital priorities fundamentally changed in response to this downturn?
They've changed dramatically. Historically, Estee Lauder's capital allocation was famously guided by the Lauder family's philosophy of patient capital. The focus was very much on long-term sustainable growth, not just hitting quarterly numbers. Their strong and usually consistent cash flow, generated from that robust core business, was deployed strategically.
How do they deploy it?
Primarily to fund organic growth initiatives, R&D, marketing for existing brands. Secondly, to make strategic acquisitions of promising emerging brands to build out the portfolio that was key to their growth. And thirdly, to consistently return capital to shareholders through steadily increasing dividends and significant share buyback programs. That was the playbook for years.
And now?
Now, the recent crisis has forced a very dramatic, very visible reprioritization. The immediate focus now is squarely on funding the significant upfront costs associated with the profit recovery and growth plan. Remember those $1.2 to $1.6 billion in restructuring charges. They need cash for that. And secondly, shoring up the balance sheet, preserving cash to ensure they have maximum financial flexibility to navigate through this demanding multi-year turnaround period. It's a definite pivot away from growth investments and shareholder returns towards preservation and funding the operational reset.
And the most tangible, maybe painful evidence of this shift for shareholders came in the returns policy, particularly the dividend. What exactly did they do there, and what signal does that send to the market?
It sent a very strong, and for dividend investors, quite painful signal. After a long, proud history of consistent, growing dividend payments often seen as a hallmark of their financial strength and stability, the company announced in November 2024, looking ahead to fiscal 2025, a significant reduction in its quarterly dividend payout.
How big a cut?
They cut it quite sharply, from $1.66 per share per quarter down to nearly 35 cents per share. Management stated this was done to achieve a more appropriate payout ratio in light of the severely depressed current earnings environment and the expected costs of the turnaround.
What's the signal there, beyond just saving cash?
Well, this move, while arguably fiscally prudent from a cash management perspective given the circumstances, is a powerful signal about the expected duration and severity of the downturn in profitability. It implicitly tells investors that management does not foresee a quick V-shaped recovery in earnings that would justify maintaining the previous payout level. They're signaling that this is going to take time, it's going to be costly, and they need to conserve cash for the journey.
Okay, so the dividend was cut significantly. What about share repurchases? Buying back stock. Historically, that's been another way they return capital to shareholders and often seen as a sign of management confidence in the stock price. Have those also been impacted?
Yes, dramatically so. Estée Lauder has historically been quite an active repurchaser of its own stock, using it to boost earnings per share and return excess cash to shareholders when they felt the stock was attractively valued. This activity actually peaked in fiscal 2022 when they spent $2.3 billion on buybacks.
And now?
Now that program has been effectively suspended. Buyback activity has been reduced to near zero in the most recent periods.
So both levers of shareholder return pulled back hard.
Exactly. This combined pivot, a sharp dividend cut and a near halt to share buybacks, represents a fundamental temporary shift in their capital allocation strategy. It clearly indicates that management's top priority right now is not direct shareholder returns. It's the preservation of capital to navigate the current business challenges and, critically, to fund that costly multi-year restructuring effort. It's like they're on a wartime footing with their balance sheet, prioritizing the core mission above all else.
That makes sense in context. So their M&A strategy, acquiring other brands, which has been such a cornerstone of their growth for decades, that must also be under scrutiny now, right? Especially with those massive impairment charges, those write-downs on past acquisitions that we talked about earlier.
It's under intense scrutiny, and rightly so. M&A has absolutely been a cornerstone of their growth and diversification strategy. They spent billions acquiring successful on-trend brands like Tom Ford Beauty, DCM, which brought them The Ordinary, and the K-beauty brand Dr. Jart, plus Aria. These were seen as smart moves at the time.
But the write-downs suggest they overpaid, or the brands underperformed expectations.
Exactly. Those recent large-scale goodwill and intangible asset impairments. Remember, totaling over $1.3 billion in just over a year, which were directly related to some of these acquisitions, particularly Dr. Jart, plus and possibly others. They have inevitably called the effectiveness and maybe the financial discipline of this growth through acquisition strategy into serious question.
What does an impairment charge actually signify?
Well, when a company takes a goodwill or intangible asset impairment, it essentially means they are formally admitting that the current estimated fair value of an acquired asset or brand is now worth significantly less than what they originally recorded it for on their balance sheet, often close to the purchase price.
Mm.
That difference, the lost value, is written off as a charge against earnings.
So it's a permanent destruction of shareholder value.
Yes, fundamentally it is. And frankly, it highlights that some of these major acquisitions were likely made at peak market valuations, perhaps driven by overly optimistic growth projections that simply haven't materialized in the face of market shifts or integration challenges. It raises questions about their capital allocation discipline during the boom years.
So M&A is likely on the back burner for now while they fix the core business.
You'd have to assume major M&A is unlikely in the near term, given the focus on cost-cutting, cash preservation, and the scrutiny on past deals. They need to digest and integrate what they have and prove the value of those acquisitions first.
What about their debt situation? Are they carrying a lot of debt from these deals or other activities? Is that a concern?
In terms of debt, the company actually maintains what analysts consider a moderate leverage profile overall. As of the last reporting period mentioned in our sources, they held approximately $3.4 billion in cash and cash equivalents against about $7.3 billion in long-term debt.
So more debt than cash, but manageable.
Generally considered manageable for a company of their size and historical cash flow generation, yes. The debt maturity profile also appears manageable, meaning they don't have huge lump sums of debt coming due all at once in the very near future, which is good. However, a potential concern is that any need to refinance existing debt as it matures, doing so in the current significantly higher interest rate environment compared to when the debt was issued would likely lead to increased annual interest expense. And that, of course, would further pressure profitability in the coming years. It's another headwind they face.
Okay, let's talk valuation. This is always tricky, especially for a company in turnaround mode. How is the market actually viewing Estee Lauder's stock right now, given all these immense challenges on one hand and the ambitious turnaround plan on the other? Because you mentioned the numbers we're seeing can be quite misleading or hard to interpret.
Yeah, the market is certainly grappling with deep uncertainty, and valuing the stock conventionally is difficult. For example, traditional trailing 12-month, TTM, price-to-earnings, PE ratios are negative because of their recent reported gap losses. So looking backward is pretty unhelpful for analysis right now.
So investors have to look forward, try to guess the future earnings.
Exactly. Investors and analysts are largely focusing on forward-looking estimates, trying to project when and, crucially, how much profitability will return as the PRGP takes effect and markets hopefully stabilize. Based on the consensus analyst forecasts available in our sources, Estee Lauder currently trades at a forward PE ratio of approximately 61 times its estimated earnings for fiscal 2025, which is ongoing, and around 40 times its estimated earnings for fiscal 2026.
60 times next year's estimated earnings, 40 times the year after. How does that compare to the overall market or their peers? That sounds really high.
It is really high, extremely high, actually. To put that in perspective, the average forward PE for the broader market, like the S&P 500, is often in the low 20s, maybe high teens sometimes. And Estee Lauder's direct competitors, like L'Oreal or even faster-growing smaller players, often trade at more moderate forward PE ratios, maybe in the 20s or low 30s.
So even while Estee Lauder is reporting losses, cutting jobs, going through massive restructuring, the market is valuing its future earnings at a huge premium to almost everyone else.
That's precisely the situation. The market is essentially saying, we believe you're going to execute this turnaround flawlessly, that earnings will rebound incredibly strongly, and we're willing to pay a very high price today for those anticipated future earnings.
That sounds like a lot of optimism baked into the share price.
An enormous amount. It implies that there's a huge expectation of not just recovery, but a robust V-shaped recovery already reflected in the current stock price. As the bears argue, this leaves very little margin for error. Any misstep in execution, any delay in the recovery timeline, and that premium valuation could evaporate very, very quickly.
So the PE picture looks stretched. What about other valuation metrics? Does their price-to-sales ratio tell a slightly different story, maybe make it look less expensive?
It does tell a slightly different story, which adds to the complexity. Their price-to-sales, PS ratio, based on trailing 12-month sales, is approximately 2.2x, according to our sources. Now, this is much more in line with, or even potentially cheaper than, some of their peer group. For instance, L'Oreal trades at around 4.2x PS, and LVMH's group is around 4.0x PS.
So, on a sales basis, maybe it looks more reasonable.
Potentially, yes. It suggests the market still values the revenue generated by their strong brands. However, and this is a big caveat, the PS ratio fails to capture the company's severely depressed profitability and margins relative to those same peers. L'Oreal and LVMH aren't just bigger. They're much more profitable in the sales they make right now.
So EL sales aren't translating into profit nearly as effectively as their competitors.
Exactly. The PS ratio highlights that while they still generate significant revenue from those iconic brands, a much smaller portion of that revenue is currently dropping to the bottom line as profit compared to their key competitors. So you have to look at both profitability, PE, and sales, PS, together to get the full picture.
Okay. So what are the absolute key drivers for this valuation then? And how incredibly sensitive is it likely to be to different outcomes? What's really going to move the needle for investors watching this stock?
The stock's valuation is clearly extraordinarily sensitive to a few key variables right now. It's like it's balanced on a knife edge. First, absolutely critical is the pace and the magnitude of the recovery in Asia. That means both mainland China consumer demand and, crucially, the stabilization and eventual recovery of that travel retail channel, albeit to a new, lower baseline.
Okay, Asia recovery is number one.
Yeah.
What else?
Second, the successful realization of those targeted cost savings from the PRGP. Hitting that $0.8 billion to $1.0 billion range in annual savings is pretty much non-negotiable for justifying the current valuation. The market is counting on it. And third, related to both of those, is their ability to reignite sustainable organic sales growth across their diversified portfolio, not just relying on cost cuts. They need to show they can grow the top line again through innovation and strong brand performance.
And the uncertainty around these factors is reflected in analyst opinions.
Massively. The wide dispersion of analyst price targets we see in our sources, ranging from a low of maybe $60 per share to a high of $110 or even more, really underscores the profound uncertainty surrounding these complex variables. It's almost like analysts are looking at two different companies, depending on how optimistic they are about the turnaround execution and the macro environment. It's a huge range, showing just how much disagreement there is about the future.
And this creates what you call an asymmetric risk profile, doesn't it? Meaning the potential downside could be far greater than the potential upside, given where the price is already.
Exactly. That's a key takeaway from the valuation analysis. There appears to be a significant disconnect between Estee Lauder's current operational reality, we're talking declining sales, negative gap earnings, major restructuring costs and disruption, and its premium forward valuation multiples.
The market's looking way past the present problems.
Completely. It implies that the market is largely looking past all the near-term difficulties and essentially giving management full credit up front for executing a successful, strong V-shaped recovery. This creates that asymmetry. If the turnaround proceeds exactly as planned or even slightly better, the stock may have somewhat limited upside from here because so much optimism is already priced in.
But if things go wrong?
But if the recovery falters, if it's delayed, if it proves less profitable than the market expects, or if there are new unforeseen headwinds, like a deeper recession, then the stock could be subject to a severe derating. The market could rapidly lose faith in the turnaround story, and those high multiples could collapse. That could lead to substantial downside for shareholders, as the market's currently high expectations are unmet. It really does look like a high reward, but perhaps even higher risk proposition at this specific valuation level.
That's a critical point for anyone considering the stock. And just one more point on the financials. When looking at their reported earnings right now, how should we approach them, especially with all these large one-time charges, the impairments, the restructuring costs that distort the underlying picture?
Yeah, that's a critical point for any deep dive into a company that's going through major changes or distress. Estee Lauder's recent GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, earnings have been significantly distorted by these huge, often non-cash impairment charges related to past acquisitions, and also by the very real but one-time restructuring costs associated with the PRGP. These items aren't really indicators of the ongoing underlying operational performance of the business.
So the headline GAAP number isn't telling the whole story.
Not at all. Similarly, their free cash flow, the cash generated after investments, has also been highly volatile. It actually turned negative in fiscal 2023, which is worrying for a company this size, before recovering somewhat as the company aggressively managed working capital, like reducing inventory, and cut back on capital expenditures to conserve cash.
So what should analysts and investors be looking at instead?
A crucial part of the analyst's job, and really your job as an informed observer trying to understand the situation, is to look through these one-time items. You need to try and assess the adjusted or normalized earnings and cash flow power of the business. What would the company be earning if you stripped out all this noise?
Trying to find the true underlying profitability.
Exactly. This normalized view, however difficult it is to calculate precisely, is what the future valuation will ultimately be based on. It strips out the temporary noise and hopefully reveals the true sustainable profitability of the ongoing operations, which is what really matters for the long term.
Okay, that's super helpful context on the financials and valuation. Let's delve even deeper now into the risks. Beyond the financial numbers and the market shifts we've discussed, what are the key business and strategic risks facing Estee Lauder that could potentially derail this whole comeback attempt?
Well, the primary risk, the one that overshadows everything else, as we've emphasized throughout, is the monumental execution risk of the turnaround itself. It just can't be overstated.
Why is it so risky?
The sheer complexity of implementing a global restructuring of this magnitude, coupled with those deep workforce reductions across different countries and functions, creates a very high probability of significant operational disruption. Things can just go wrong when you change so much at once.
Like what kind of disruptions?
This could manifest as delays in new product launches because teams are disorganized or key people have left. It could lead to issues with the supply chain, getting products made and shipped efficiently. It could even cause a decline in customer service levels if morale is low or processes are broken. All of this could further impact sales negatively, damage employee morale and the overall corporate culture, and potentially lead to a failure to realize the full extent of those targeted cost savings if the changes don't stick or prove counterproductive. A plan this aggressive inherently carries equally aggressive potential pitfalls.
Okay, execution risk is number one. What else keeps the bears up at night? The competitive landscape seems like a constant, ever-present threat, making it potentially hard for them to regain lost ground. It absolutely is. That's the second major risk cluster. Competitive threats and market share erosion. The prestige beauty market, as we've discussed, is intensely competitive, and it's arguably become even more so during Estee Lauder's recent period of struggle and distraction.
So competitors have taken advantage.
It seems likely. There's a very material risk that the market share Estee Lauder has lost during this period of disruption, lost to more agile, often digitally native competitors, ranging from global giants like L'Oreal, who are executing well, to fast-growing indie brands capturing niche audiences, and even those insurgent K-beauty players offering great value, that some of that lost share may become permanent.
Why permanent?
Because consumer loyalty isn't what it used to be. These competitors haven't been standing still while EL was focused internally. They've been innovating, marketing aggressively, building relationships with consumers, especially online. A persistent failure by Estee Lauder to innovate at the pace of the market now, or to effectively communicate their unique value proposition to new generations of consumers, could lead to a permanent drag on their organic growth, preventing them from fully regaining their footing as a market leader, even if the turnaround plan succeeds in cutting costs.
And that dependence on China and Asia travel retail, despite all the talk of diversification, that still feels like a huge concentration risk, doesn't it? It feels like they're still heavily tethered to the fortunes of those volatile markets.
They absolutely are. That's the third key risk. Despite stated efforts over the years to diversify geographically and by channel, the company's overall financial health remains profoundly correlated with the spending habits of the Chinese consumer and the specific dynamics of the Asia travel retail channel. This constitutes a substantial single point of failure, or at least vulnerability, that has already proven incredibly impactful, as we've seen.
So what could go wrong there still?
Well, a prolonged or deeper than expected economic slowdown in China could certainly hurt them. A sustained shift in consumer preferences there away from established foreign luxury brands towards increasingly sophisticated domestic Chinese brands, C-beauty, is a real threat. Or further adverse regulatory changes by the Chinese government impacting imports, e-commerce, or marketing could severely impede the company's recovery prospects. Even if other markets like the U.S. and Europe perform reasonably well, a significant stumble or disappointment in China or failure of travel retail to recover, as hoped, could still undermine the entire turnaround narrative and financial projections.
Okay, those are big company-specific and market-specific risks. What about broader financial and market risks that aren't just about beauty, but can impact any global luxury company right now?
Sure. As a provider of high-end discretionary goods, things people want but don't necessarily need, Estee Lauder is inherently highly vulnerable to downturns in the global macroeconomic cycle. That's always true for luxury.
Meaning a recession would hit them hard.
Yes, a significant global recession, or even just sustained high inflation that continues to erode consumer purchasing power, or a widespread decrease in consumer confidence. Any of those could lead to a substantial pullback in spending on prestige beauty products, directly impacting EL's revenue and profitability. People cut back on luxuries first when times get tough.
And currency fluctuations, they sell all over the world.
That's another one. With a substantial portion of its sales and operations outside the United States, the company is constantly exposed to foreign currency translation risk. For example, a strengthening U.S. dollar, which we've seen at times recently, can negatively impact their reported sales and earnings when those revenues earned in euros, yen, or other currencies are converted back into dollars for financial reporting. It can make growth look weaker than it is in local currency terms.
And what about operational risks beyond execution, like supply chain vulnerabilities or geopolitical risks? We've certainly seen a lot of that impacting global supply chains in recent years.
Indeed. Those remain relevant risks. The company's complex global supply chain, with ingredients sourced from all over the world and products manufactured and distributed worldwide, is susceptible to disruptions. These could come from geopolitical events, wars, conflicts. They could come from international trade disputes leading to new tariffs or restrictions, or just plain logistics challenges like port closures, shipping delays, or spikes in freight costs.
And the impact.
These can lead to increased costs, inventory imbalances, too much of the wrong thing, not enough of the right thing, and ultimately missed sales opportunities if they can't get products to market efficiently. Furthermore, on the legal front, The company still faces ongoing risk from that shareholder class action lawsuit related to its disclosures, or lack thereof, about the Daegu market. That could potentially result in significant financial penalties, or at least ongoing reputational damage.
And regulatory risks. The rules keep changing.
Always a factor in beauty. Evolving regulations for cosmetic ingredients, product safety standards, labeling requirements, particularly in key stringent markets like China and the European Union, could also increase compliance costs, force product reformulations, and impact their ability to sell certain products, requiring constant adaptation and investment in regulatory affairs.
Okay, that's a comprehensive look at the risks. Let's talk about the people steering the ship through this storm: management quality and corporate governance. Particularly with the recent leadership transition at the CEO level, how significant is this change, and what does it mean for the company's future direction?
This is a truly pivotal event for the company's future, make no mistake.
Yeah.
The departure of a long-serving and for many years highly successful CEO like Fabrizio Freda, who oversaw that incredible era of growth, and the appointment of Stefan de la Favre, even though he's an experienced internal executive, it marks a definitive new chapter.
What's de la Favre's background? What does he bring to the table?
His profile appears strong on paper. He has deep experience within Estée Lauder, which is valuable. He knows the culture, the brands, the people. His track record includes successfully growing the flagship Estée Lauder brand itself, particularly in China during better times, and also successfully scaling up acquired brands like the niche fragrance house Le Labo, showing he can nurture both established giants and integrate newer, trendier brands. That's a good combination of skills.
But he's stepping in at a tough time.
The toughest time. He inherits an organization facing its most profound and complex set of challenges in probably over a decade, maybe longer. His ability to not just manage the situation, but to truly drive the necessary cultural and operational change throughout the entire global entity to make beauty reimagined a reality, not just a slogan, will be absolutely paramount to the success of this turnaround. He's certainly got his work cut out for him, and the pressure will be immense from day one.
And the Lauder family's influence, that's a unique aspect of Estée Lauder compared to many other large publicly traded companies. How does their continuing involvement factor into corporate governance and decision-making?
Corporate governance at Estée Lauder is uniquely and fundamentally shaped by the continued, very active involvement of the founding Lauder family. It's still very much a family-influenced company, even though it's public. Members of the family, including Executive Chairman William P. Lauder, grandson of Estée Lauder, hold key leadership positions and prominent roles on the board of directors.
And they have voting control, right, through special shares.
Yes, that's the crucial mechanism. Through their ownership of super voting Class B shares, the Lauder family controls approximately 84% of the outstanding voting power of the company. This dual-class share structure is quite common in family-controlled companies that go public.
What are the implications of that, good and bad?
Well, the positive argument is that it ensures a very strong focus on long-term value creation, rather than just chasing short-term quarterly results. It provides remarkable stability and allows management, theoretically, to pursue multi-year strategic initiatives like this turnaround plan without constant pressure from short-term-oriented activist investors trying to force breakups or quick fixes.
And the downside?
The downside, from the perspective of public shareholders, is that it inherently limits the influence of those public Class A shareholders on major corporate decisions, like electing directors or approving mergers. Their votes are significantly diluted by the family's super voting shares. So, public shareholders have less say than they would in a company with a single class of shares. The board of directors itself is composed of a mix of Lauder family members, company executives, and, importantly, a majority of independent directors with diverse external backgrounds, which theoretically provides some checks and balances on family control. But the ultimate power resides with the Class B shares.
Okay, that's important context on the governance. Finally, before we revisit the core investment thesis, what about their sustainability initiatives? We talked about it as a market trend. Is Estée Lauder taking it seriously? Is it just a PR play for them? Or does it have real business impact in terms of attracting consumers and managing long-term risks?
It appears to have very real business implications now, both reputational and operational. And they seem to be taking it increasingly seriously, partly because consumers are demanding it. Estée Lauder has placed a growing emphasis in its public reporting and strategy on its social impact and sustainability initiatives. They recognize that modern consumers, particularly that crucial Gen Z demographic, increasingly scrutinize brand values and environmental footprints.
What are their specific focuses?
A key focus area is on responsible sourcing of ingredients, particularly for plant-derived ingredients and forest-based commodities like paperboard for packaging. They've set some ambitious, measurable goals in this area. For example, they aim to have 100% of their forest-based fiber cartons certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, FSC, a credible standard by the end of calendar year 2025. They also aim to ensure at least 95% of their palm-based ingredients, a historically controversial commodity, are certified as sustainable.
So tangible goals, what's the business impact?
Well, these initiatives are absolutely crucial for appealing to that modern, environmentally conscious consumer who might otherwise choose a smaller, seemingly more ethical brand. It helps protect their brand reputation. But beyond reputation, these efforts also serve to mitigate long-term supply chain risks by ensuring continued access to ethically sourced raw materials, which could become scarcer or more regulated in the future.
Are there downsides to these initiatives?
The main challenge is that these efforts can, and often do, increase operational complexity and costs in the short term. Ensuring compliance, traceability, and certification across a vast global supplier network requires significant investment in systems and personnel. So it's an investment in future relevance and resilience, but it might not immediately boost the bottom line.
Okay, that makes sense. So after laying out all these incredibly complex factors, the shifting market, the deep financial struggles, the aggressive turnaround plan, the numerous risks, the unique governance, let's bring it all back to the core investment thesis. For you, the listener, trying to make sense of all this, what does the bull case, the optimistic path to recovery, really look like for Estée Lauder now? What has to go right?
All right, the argument for a successful recovery, the bull case, really rests on several key, largely interdependent pillars. First, and perhaps the most powerful and enduring argument, is their unparalleled brand equity. You just can't ignore it.
The strength of those names.
Exactly. Estée Lauder's portfolio contains some of the most powerful, enduring, globally recognized, and highly aspirational brands in the entire prestige beauty industry. This deep well of brand loyalty, consumer aspiration, and the emotional connection people have with brands like Clinique, La Mer, Jo Malone, it provides a remarkably resilient foundation upon which to rebuild the business. It should allow them, bulls argue, to maintain premium pricing and retain relevance even through challenging economic cycles. These brands aren't just fads. They are institutions for many consumers.
Okay, brand power is pillar one. What's next? That turnaround plan delivering.
Yes, pillar two is the successful execution of the Profit Recovery and Growth Plan, PRGP, leading to significant margin expansion. The bulls see the PRGP not just as necessary medicine, but as a decisive and potentially transformative step. If management successfully executes the plan and actually achieves its targeted $0.8 billion to $1.0 billion in annual gross cost savings, the operational leverage, as sales eventually stabilize and hopefully start growing again, could be truly immense.
Meaning profits could snap back very quickly.
Potentially, yes. This leaner, more efficient cost structure, combined with even modest revenue growth down the line, could theoretically drive a dramatic expansion in operating margins, leading to a significant and perhaps quite rapid recovery in earnings per share, potentially even surpassing historical levels if they get both costs down and sales up. It's a bet on the power of restructuring to unlock latent profitability.
And the Asia situation, China and travel retail, the bulls would argue that's largely cyclical, not structural, meaning it will eventually turn around and provide a strong tailwind for Estée Lauder's recovery.
Yes, that's the third crucial pillar for the bulls. A cyclical recovery in Asia. They posit that the extreme weakness we've seen recently in mainland China and in the Asia travel retail channel is largely cyclical in nature rather than purely structural and permanent, though they'd concede the Daigou element is gone for good.
So they think the underlying demand is still there.
They believe the broader Chinese economic slowdown and the dip in consumer sentiment are temporary phenomena. As the Chinese economy eventually stabilizes, as consumer confidence returns, and as the travel retail channel finds its new, smaller post-Daigou equilibrium, Estée Lauder, as a long-standing market leader with deep relationships and strong brand recognition in the region, stands to be a prime beneficiary of the inevitable rebound in demand for prestige beauty. They believe the market will eventually adapt and normalize, and EL is best positioned among Western brands to capture that recovery when it happens.
Okay, brands, cost cuts, Asia rebound. Is there a fourth pillar, maybe the new leadership?
Absolutely. The fourth pillar for the bulls is the potential catalyst of new leadership. The appointment of a new CEO, Stéphane de La Faverie, particularly an internal candidate who knows the challenges firsthand, could be the decisive factor needed to break through any longstanding organizational inertia and inject fresh energy and perspective.
Fresh start, basically.
Exactly. His fresh perspective, hopefully combined with his deep internal knowledge of the company culture and operations, plus his proven track record in key markets like China, and with successfully scaling acquired brands like Lalabo. Bulls hoped this might be the ideal combination to accelerate the turnaround, improve execution discipline across the board, and perhaps most importantly, reignite the company's innovative spirit, both in terms of new product development and more modern, effective marketing. It's a chance for a real reset at the very top.
So that's the optimistic outlook. Strong brands, successful cost cutting, an Asia rebound, and effective new leadership all coming together. It paints a picture of a potential strong recovery.
That does. If all those things align, the upside could be significant, although arguably much of it is already reflected in the current valuation.
Right. So let's hear the equally compelling bear case again, perhaps synthesized now. What are the persistent headwinds and the major execution risks that could seriously derail this recovery and make Estee Lauder a far less attractive investment, potentially even a value trap?
Okay, the argument against a successful recovery, the bear case, is indeed equally compelling. And it centers on that execution risk and the possibility that some market shifts are structural and irreversible. First and foremost for the bears is that severe execution risk associated with the PRGP.
Just the sheer difficulty of pulling it off.
Exactly. The scale of this plan is immense, touching every part of the global business. And large-scale corporate restructurings, especially those involving massive job cuts, are notoriously difficult to execute flawlessly. There's a significant tangible risk of prolonged operational disruption, the loss of critical key talent and vital institutional knowledge walking out the door, and ultimately a failure to realize the full projected cost savings if morale plummets or the new structures don't work as intended. This could actually leave the company in a weaker, not stronger, competitive position than before the plan was even initiated.
Okay, execution risk is huge. What about the market share losses they've experienced? Could those indeed be permanent, leading to a permanently diminished competitive standing for EL?
That's the second core concern for the bears. Permanent market share loss. They argue forcefully that the competitive landscape in beauty has fundamentally, structurally changed during Estée Lauder's recent period of internal disruption and market challenges. The vacuum created by their struggles, particularly in key battlegrounds like the U.S. online market and in China, has been eagerly filled by more agile, often digitally savvy competitors.
Who are eating their lunch, basically.
Potentially, yes. From direct-to-consumer brands mastering social media, to the K-beauty juggernauts continuing their global expansion, to even giants like L'Oreal pressing their advantage. There's a considerable risk, the bears believe, that the market share Estée Lauder has lost, particularly among younger consumers who may have formed loyalties elsewhere, may not be easily regained. Consumers have found new favorites, new routines, and the cost of winning them back might be prohibitively high, leading to a permanently reduced market position and slower long-term growth potential.
And you've hammered this home throughout our discussion. The Asia travel retail problem might not be cyclical at all, but largely structural, meaning a permanent impairment to what was their biggest growth engine.
Precisely. That's the third pillar of the bear case. Structural, not cyclical. Headwinds in key markets. The bear case firmly argues that the challenges in Asia travel retail, specifically the collapse of the Daegu market, are not merely a temporary downturn that will bounce back with more travel. They see it as a permanent structural impairment to Estée Lauder's long-term growth potential.
The boom times are over for good in that channel.
The Daegu-fueled boom is definitively over, yes. The bears believe that channel may simply never return to its former size or its former profitability levels. Mm. This means what was once a massive high-margin growth engine for the company will likely become a much smaller, perhaps more stable, but significantly less impactful business going forward. And that fundamentally lowers Estée Lauder's realistic long-term revenue and margin potential compared to what the market might have assumed just a few years ago. It's a new, smaller normal for that once powerful channel.
And this all comes back, finally, to the valuation, doesn't it? If the market is indeed already pricing in a perfect recovery, any stumble, any proof that the bears are right about structural issues could be incredibly costly for shareholders.
That's the final crucial nail in the coffin for the bear case, the stretched valuation. As we discussed, the stock's current forward valuation multiples, particularly that extremely high forward PE ratio of 40-60 times estimated earnings, appear to already price in a flawless rapid and robust recovery, leaving very little margin for safety.
No room for bad news.
It's essentially none. Any delays in the turnaround hitting its targets, any further negative surprises emerging from China or travel retail, any broader macroeconomic slowdown that hurts luxury spending, or simply slower than expected organic growth as they struggle to regain share. Any of these could trigger a significant derating of the stock's valuation by the market.
Meaning the multiple compresses sharply.
Oh, they got that.
Exactly. The market could rapidly lose faith and decide EL doesn't deserve that premium multiple, leading to substantial downside for shareholders as the share price recalibrates to a more realistic, less optimistic future scenario. From the bear perspective, the risk-reward ratio at the current valuation just looks highly unfavorable. Too much can go wrong, and the market isn't pricing that possibility in.
Wow. What a journey we've taken today with the Estee Lauder companies. From its incredible historical dominance, a true paragon of luxury beauty, to its current quite precarious position navigating a truly transformative, maybe even existential period. It's a compelling story of an industry titan grappling with monumental shifts both internally and externally. It really is a classic case study unfolding in real time.
As we wrap up this deep dive, here's something maybe to leave you, our listeners, with. What does Estee Lauder's challenging journey truly tell us about the real cost of prestige in today's rapidly changing world? How does a company built entirely on the allure of iconic brands, exclusivity, and premium pricing effectively balance that historical legacy with the harsh new realities of evolving consumer values that demand transparency and affordability, the undeniable rise of credible dupes, and the relentless disruptive force of digital transformation?
It's the ultimate balancing act, isn't it? Preserving the magic while adapting to the new reality.
Exactly. This particular story of this specific beauty giant at a crossroads, it really illuminates the universal challenges of adaptation, resilience, and strategic reinvention that face almost any established industry leader in today's world. It seems it's no longer just about what you sell, but how you sell it, how you connect with consumers, and maybe most importantly, how quickly you can fundamentally change your organization when the world around you changes at such a blistering pace.
A profound question for any legacy company.
Definitely something profound to mull over. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.